Hello, and welcome to the First 10 Pages. This is the podcast where we talk about scripts and movies. We read the first 10 pages of the script, and then we discuss the movie, and by we, I mean me. That's right. So, the movie we're doing this week. Oh, and I should say, why do we do the first 10 pages? Because the studios, they look at your movie script, and you've got 10 pages to catch their attention. If you don't do it, you're done. That's it. So, you know, get it right, man, chick, whoever you are. Get it right. Do your writing. Be sure you're writing it in script format. Oh my God, I see so many scripts posted online that are written as prose or is written in something that's not a script. Yeah, you can play with format, but know it first, then play with it. All right. Let's get into this month's script. We're doing Legally Blonde. And I know, if you've seen my other episodes, you're going, Legally Blonde? Why Legally Blonde?
I mean, you did Get Out, you did Jaws, you did A Christmas Story. Where does Legally Blonde fit in all this?
First of all, don't talk like that. It's very annoying. Secondly, the reason we're doing Legally Blonde is, well, think about it. This was a big movie. It spawned a sequel. It spawned straight to video sequels. It came out of a popular book, first of all. And it was a Broadway musical, for heaven's sake. And of course, there is the prequel series that is coming out. So this is a movie that came out in 2001. Here we are about 25 years later, and they're still making spin-offs from it. This is a big deal movie. It may not be considered a classic like Jaws, but it certainly seems to have become an indelible part of our culture. Also, let's be real. Just a good, fun movie. Is it perfect? No, it's not perfect. Few movies are. Princess Bride, The In-Laws, Jaws. It's a short list. There's others, but they're not many. This is not one of those perfect movies, but it's solid. It's good. Some of the women empowerment stuff didn't age well. Even Reese Witherspoon has acknowledged that, and perhaps that's why we're getting the prequel. But okay, let's get on with some facts. Legally Blonde had one hell of a cast. Oh my God. Reese Witherspoon, Luke Wilson, Selma Blair, Victor Garber, Jennifer Coolidge, Holland Taylor, Ali Larter, director Oz Perkins, Linda Cardellini, and a cameo by Raquel Welch. This is a hell of a cast. You know, it went away for a while, and it seems to have come back. Soon after this movie, studios seemed to focus just on getting the big star in, and then all the supporting cast and the day players and a lot of movies were less familiar or less popular or less experienced actors than, say, this cast. And I'll tell you, it makes a big difference. You know, Holland Taylor, for instance, is only in a few scenes, and you do not forget those scenes. She's amazing. She's always been amazing. Victor Garber plays a perfect dick of a professor and lawyer. Ali Larter couldn't have been cast better. I mean, just perfect up and down this cast list. Just amazing. Distributed by 20th Century Fox internationally and MGM here in the United States and North America. It came out in July of 2001. It was a big summer movie. Reese Witherspoon was a known name and a known entity because of like Election and a couple of other flicks. But not flicks, I said, and I mentioned Election. If you've seen Election, you get it. But she wasn't Reese Witherspoon yet, you know? This was, I think, her first big vehicle after Election. I could be mistaken. I'm not looking it up. I'm too lazy. But certainly no one looked at Reese Witherspoon as the kind of leading lady that she plays in this movie, which somehow made it perfect. It was made with a budget of $18 million, and it earned $142 million. It was based on a book. I read a little bit about the book. I even read a little bit of the book. One of the things that I recall reading is that the author, I think it was Amanda Brown? Yes, Amanda Brown, was that she was having trouble getting publishers to look at it. So what she started doing was she printed it out on pink pages, and when she sent the manuscript out, people were receiving this bright pink manuscript. The screenplay was written by Kirsten Smith and Karen McCullough. They had first teamed up for a different adaptation, a teenage take on Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew, the famed film 10 Things I Hate About You, which I've not seen in a long time, but I think everyone agrees it is a pretty great movie. They also wrote Ella Enchanted, also based on a book, and 12th Night, which I hear was an adaptation. They worked on She's the Man as well, which I had never seen until recently. I watched it before recording this podcast, and you know what? Good movie. These two have a pretty good record. They do good work. Which is interesting because the script, and I'm going to get to the script read in a moment, but the script has a lot of strange things that don't seem to belong in a script. Not a lot, a few strange things that don't belong in the script, certainly in the first 10 pages. And I call those out. At the end of the day, it didn't matter because they were established screenwriters. They wrote a great script, turned out to be a great movie, that the director made some changes to the script to make it really great. But I still think, in a script, stick to writing a script. Your actions should describe what's on the screen, and you can still be artistic and poetic, but don't tell me someone's emotions. The movie was directed by Robert Luketic. He was an Australian director, and this was his big break. And after the script read, you'll see the difference. The things that he took and tweaked just ever so slightly. Changes of dialogues, slight cuts, things like that. Minor, though, really made a huge difference in those first 10 minutes. All right, now let's get to the script read. You can skip the script read, but let's face it, it's the best part. It's the reason you're here, right? I mean, this time, it's definitely the reason why you're here. It's got to be the reason, right? Yeah, okay. So with that said, if you don't want to listen to it, it's up to you. Skip to this time.
18 minutes, 55 seconds.
Okay, here we go.
Now, keep in mind, I am a boy, and pretty much all the characters in Legally Blonde are girls. I'm gonna do the best I can. So sit back and enjoy Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's Legally Blonde by Karen McCullough-Lutz and Kirsten Smith. I'm reading a shooting draft from July 31, 2000. Although at the top of the next page, it says September 1st, 2000, revision. Blue. Interior Delta Gamma House. Day. Head Over Heels by the Go-Go's plays as we wind through a flock of abstract silky golden strands, pulling back to discover that the strands are hair on a blonde girl's head. But not just any blonde girl, a girl in Delta Gamma, the blondest, most beautiful sorority at USC. We pull back further to see that she's signing a handmade card. She holds it up over her shoulders. We see hearts and glitter surrounding, and "Good luck tonight" and "L and Warner forever" written on the card. It doesn't say that. I had to add it because it's in quotes. She carries the card out of her room, and we follow her across the hall into the room of three blonde cheerleaders who stop practicing their pom-pom routine to sign the card. As they finish, we follow the card girl out into the room of a blonde girl in a tank top and shorts working out on a Stairmaster as General Hospital plays on a tiny TV. She signs the card while continuing to exercise. We move on to the room of a blonde girl making out with her boyfriend who stops long enough to sign the card as her boyfriend nibbles on her neck. She hands the card back, and we head into the room of a blonde party girl, who pours a pink frozen margarita into a glass from the blender, then passes it down to another blonde girl, assembly line style. The card goes one way, being signed as the drinks go the other. Once the card arrives back in the card girl's hands, we follow her out of the room and down the hall until she reaches the very last and biggest door. She puts a kiss mark on the card, then kneels down and slides the card under the door. Interior. L's Delta Gamma Room. Day. Continuous. The card slides into the pink room, hitting the feet of Underdog, a tiny chihuahua who picks it up in his mouth and trots it over to a pair of perfectly pedicured feet in strappy sandals. An equally perfectly manicured hand with a Sisters Forever charm bracelet dangling from the wrist scoops up Underdog. As he rises, we rise with him, passing toned wax tanned legs in pink Prada petal pushers and a pair of perky boobs encased in a spaghetti strap top, until we finally reveal a magnificent head of long blonde hair and a sweet, beautiful face. This is Elle Woods, 21, the goddess queen of Delta Gamma. She talks on a pink, fuzzy phone. Elle, into phone. "I love you too." Behind her, a Go USC banner is pinned to the pink wall. A stack of Cosmopolitans and Glamours teeters on the dresser. The closet overflows with trendy designer clothes and a predominance of pink. Elle, continuing to phone, "I'll see you tonight." She hangs up and lets out a squeal of joy, which I'm not going to do. Kissing Underdog's head and taking the card out of his mouth. She reads it, touched. "Elle and Warner forever. Aww." Underdog yips. Interior, Delta Gamma House, living room, day, same time. A Delta Gamma Sigma Chi barbecue is in full swing. Beautiful college students drink beer and mingle, trying to figure out who they're going to sleep with next. The main wall of the living room has been designated as a model wall of Delta Gamma girls. Elle smiles at us from a Hawaiian Tropic ad and a Miss June USC calendar photo. A cover of an Italian Vogue shows a blonde sex pop, Margot. A USC cheerleader poster displays a hard-body non-blonde, Serena, in a pom-pom pose. Serena walks up, fending off an admirer.
Jeremy, enough. I am not going to formal with you.
Jeremy slinks off as Margot arrives, agitated. Margot.
Can someone please tell Rick he is not the only Sigma Chi with a big penis?
Elle off-screen.
You guys are so sweet.
Elle, a vision of fluffy blondness, runs down the stairs towards Serena and Margot, holding the card.
But I am not positive it's going to happen tonight.
Hello? He just had lunch with his grandmother. You know he got the rock.
Why else would she have flown in from Newport? It's not like she's going to FedEx a 6-carat diamond.
Elle excited.
You think?
I can't believe you're getting engaged.
The three girls jump up and down, squealing and hugging.
Come on, you have to help me pick out the perfect outfit.
As they head towards the door, Elle spots Amy, a shy girl in a Delta Gamma Pledge sweatshirt, standing alone. Elle, continuing,
Amy, what's wrong?
I don't really know anyone.
Teasing.
That's because you spend too much time in the library. Come with me.
To Serena and Margot.
I'll meet you outside.
As they go, Elle leads Amy over to a group of jovial Sigma Chi brothers. Elle, continuing,
Brandon, Jason, Grant, this is Amy. Why don't you tell her about the time you guys went golfing naked?
Elle winks at Amy and heads off as the guys launch into their story.
It was classic. Jason hit with wood all day, and we never ran out of balls.
Interior, Sunset Plaza Boutique, day. Serena and Margot watch as Elle stands in front of a mirror, trying on a Hervé
Ledger?
I don't know. White mini dress. Sexy and ultra tight. Elle,
too demure?
I think you should go for red. It's the color of confidence.
Well, I don't want to look like I know what's coming.
Serena,
I don't understand why you're completely disregarding your signature color.
She holds up a tiny pink slip dress.
He's proposing. I can't look like I would on any date. This is the date. The night I'll always remember. I want to look special, bridal, but not like I suspect anything.
Across the store, a saleswoman looks at her cohort. Saleswoman, Sato.
There's nothing I love more than a dumb blonde with daddy's plastic.
She grabs a dress off the clearance sale rack, ripping off the half price tag. Then on Elle and the girls.
I can't wait to see you wearing the rock.
Elle looks at them, suddenly concerned.
What if, you know, it's not the night?
Why else would he be taking you to the Ivy? You've been dating for a year. It's not like he's trying to impress you.
Elle, you've heard the man pass gas in his sleep. That practically means you're pre-engaged.
The saleswoman approaches with the dress, kissy-assy smile on her face. Saleswoman.
Did you see this one? We just got it in yesterday.
Elle fingers the dress, then the new price tag, looking back at the saleswoman excited.
Is this a low viscosity rayon?
Yes, of course.
With half loop top stitching on the hem?
Smiling a lie.
Absolutely, it's one of a kind.
Elle hands the dress back to her, no longer pretending to be excited.
It's impossible to use a half loop top stitch on low viscosity rayon. It would snag the fabric. And you didn't just get this in, because I remembered from the June Vogue a year ago. So if you're trying to sell it to me at full price,
you picked the wrong girl. The saleswoman slinks off embarrassed. Margot to the saleswoman.
Nice try.
Elle shakes her head and turns back to the girl so she slips on her Manolo Blahnik sandals, doing one last mirror check, smoothing down her golden mane. Elle dramatically.
Girls, this is it. In a few hours, I'll be the future Mrs. Warner Huntington III.
Exterior Delta Gamma House night. An attractive male finger presses the door.
It's an attractive male finger? Okay. Presses the doorbell.
Interior. Interior Delta Gamma House. Foyer. Night. Same time. Amy peeks through the peephole and turns.
Amy whispering, he's here?
Elle standing nearby with Margot and Serena and several other DGs smooth down her dress and takes a deep breath. Opening door to find Warner Huntington III, 21, tall, chiseled, and outrageously handsome. He takes her in, a smile spreading across his face.
You're beautiful.
So are you.
She looks up at him, blushing and completely smitten. They kiss. After a moment, Warner extracts himself. Warner, nervous.
You ready? Her face is awash with devotion. I am so ready. Exterior of the Ivy, night. Warner and Elle are seated at a cozy table on the patio. Elle takes a sip from her freshly poured champagne flute, nervous and excited. Here's to us. Warner is slower to sip his. The reason I wanted to come here tonight was to discuss our future. Elle is on the edge of her seat. I'm fully amenable to that discussion. I mean, we're having a lot of fun now, but things are going to be different when I'm at Harvard Law School. It's a completely different world. I need to be serious. Of course, my family expects a lot from me, and I expect a lot from me. I plan on running for office someday, and I fully support that. But the thing is, if I'm going to be a senator by the time I'm 30, I can't keep dicking around. I completely agree. That's why I think it's time for us to. Elle takes a deep breath, filled with anticipation. I think we should break up. Elle's champagne glass drops from her hand and crashes onto the patio.
What?
Elle starts to flush, completely caught off guard. I'm sorry, Elle.
You're breaking up with me? I thought you were proposing.
Warner. Proposing? Elle, if I'm going to be a politician, I need to marry a Jackie, not a Marilyn.
You're breaking up with me because I'm too blonde?
That's not entirely.
Then what? My boobs are too big?
Elle, no, your boobs are fine. Her tears start.
So when you said you'd always love me, you were just dicking around?
Warner looks around the restaurant nervously.
I do love you, Elle. I just can't marry you. You have no idea the pressure I'm under. My family has 5 generations of senators. My brother is in the top 3 at Yale Law. He just got engaged to a Vanderbilt, for Christ's sakes.
Elle stares at him aghast, tears streaming down her face, then pushes her chair away from the table and walks out.
It's not like I have a choice, sweetheart.
He follows her out. Exterior street, night. Elle teeters down the sidewalk as best she can in her 3-inch heels, sobbing. Warner pulls up alongside her in his convertible Saab.
Come on, let me take you home. No.
Elle, it's 20 miles back to campus. Elle stops, thinks a minute, then gets in, still crying. Catching her poofy little purse in the door, she reopens it, yanking the purse back in. Warner pulls out. Exterior, Delta Gamma House, USC, night. Warner pulls up in front. It's a starry, romantic night. Everything should be perfect. It's not. Elle sits, still in shock, as tears continue to eke out.
Elle, believe me, I never expected to be doing this, but I think it's the right thing to do. How can it be the right thing if we're not together?
I have to think about my future and what people expect from me.
So you're breaking up with me because you're afraid your family won't like me? Everybody likes me.
East Coast people are different. Just because I'm not a Vanderbilt, all of a sudden I'm white trash?
I grew up in Bel Air, Warner, across the street from Aaron Spelling.
I think most people would agree that's way better than a Vanderbilt.
I told you, Elle, I need someone serious. I'm seriously in love with you. Isn't that enough?
He looks away.
I'm sorry.
She gets out of the car and drags herself up the stairs to her sorority house. When she's at the top, she turns back to look at him, his perfect cheekbones highlighted by the street lamp. Sorry. He meets her eyes, pained but determined, then pulls away, leaving her there. Interior, Delta Gamma House, USC, night. Elle walks down the pink and green carpeted hall, dazed and tear-stained. Margot and Serena emerge from the bathroom, post-shower, getting ready for a night out. Margot.
Why are you back so soon?
Serena sees Elle's bare hand.
Did he forget the ring?
Elle silently walks into her room. Serena and Margot follow, worried. Interior, Elle's Delta Gamma room, night continuous. Elle slumps down in an inflatable chair, hugging her knees and cowering in a wretched little ball. Underdog, that's her chihuahua, as a reminder, stares at her, concerned. Serena and Margot stand at the door. Margot.
Elle?
Serena.
Where's the rock?
We're not engaged. It's over.
Serena and Margot.
What?
Broke up.
Serena and Margot gasp in horror, rushing to her side.
Is it a kappa?
Margot.
It's not a theta.
It's just not me. I'm canceling the mixer. We'll blacklist Sigma Chi.
Thank you, Serena, but I don't think it'll do any good.
And we are done.
You know what? I'm actually going to start with the book before we talk about the script. There's a lot to get in on this one. So I read about the first 4 chapters. No, I read about 75 pages of the book. I just realized. I read the book like 4 months ago, and I wrote down that I was going to read the first 4 chapters, but no, I read like the first 70, 80 pages. Honestly, I thought it was a tween novel. I did not think that this was general fiction, chick lit for adults. I had to go look it up and check it. The writing is solid, but definitely felt like it was for younger people. And I'm not sure who the audience for the book really is. The chapters are super short. Some of them were just like 2.5 pages or something like that. The tone is set oddly from start when Elle's friends Margot and Serena, and yeah, all the characters have the same names, they're arguing about Serena's boob job. And it establishes that Elle's father did the work, which is awkward. It all read a bit salacious to me. It's written like it's for a teen audience, but also it has this sort of salacious opening. And again, it's just women talking about boobs and getting their lips done, and I don't think it's meant to be salacious, but it explained why the first script adaptation, according to what I read, was more along the lines of American Pie. This was in a New York Times article about the film's development. It also explains why Elle, in the script, seems like she's supposed to be more college-age Pam Anderson and less Cher from Clueless. But I stress seems because the book is based on the real-life experiences of the author. So honestly, I'm just uncertain if this is just my male point of view misunderstanding her intent, or if maybe it's one of those situations where the movie outshines the book, which happens every now and again. Forrest Gump is a fantastic example of that. I had trouble getting a handle for what Elle was supposed to be personality-wise in the book. She doesn't seem any different than her sorority sisters. It's just, here's a bunch of pretty girls who are obsessed with their looks. But the script and the movie, they make it clear that there's something special about Elle very early on. Later on in the book, but still within those first like 75 or so pages, there are some of those sparks of intelligence and originality that become more important, but it is very clunky. Whereas the movie hints and foreshadows Elle's wit and intelligence and quick thinking, while still portraying her as a self-involved sorority girl obsessed with looks and fashion, the book only does the latter, until I imagine that it doesn't. You know, when it becomes important for the story for her to be more diverse in her thinking and her abilities and things like that. The girls are seemingly obsessed with makeup tips from Cosmo and other mags and obsess over Elle's choice of dress from her closet, not a store by the way, for her date with Warner. There is seemingly no fashion, style, or other expertise on the part of Elle, and by the end of chapter one you get no sense that Elle is smart or sophisticated. Pipe that is very clearly laid in the film script super fast. They're girly girls in the book, but in a different way from Elle and her friends in the movie. In the Ivy restaurant, the book becomes very much about its Hollywood setting, with name drops from J-Lo to Will Smith, waiters are actors, valets are screenwriters, things like that, which felt very much out of Clueless for me. But I'm fairly certain someone thought this was clever satire. And for that, if you're interested in clever satire in book form about Hollywood, I would recommend the Get Shorty novel by Elmore Leonard. The book speeds through Elle's prep for Stanford Law School. It's Warner's brother who attended Harvard in the book, and just says that the LSATs were easy for her. It doesn't go into her studying the way the movie does. I think that's enough on the book. Let's now talk script! They tell you that one of the rules of screenwriting is to not write the names of songs in your script. I feel like that's bunk. If you have a very specific song that's going to create a very specific tone for your very specific moment or character or whatever it is, then yeah, man, name that song. Don't do it a lot. One of my screenplays, it takes place in 1991, and I say Jesus Jones's Right Here, Right Now is booming from a radio, or some other similar 1991 rock anthem. Should some director one day take it and go, what about something from you too? Then, you know, more power to you, man. But that was the song of the year. That said, I've got a ton of notes on this script because there are so many little tiny tweaks between the script and what ended up on screen. Head Over Heels by the Go-Go's is what's supposed to play at the beginning of this. I do think Perfect Day by Hoku worked much better. I don't think Head Over Heels gives the right tone at all, if I'm being honest. It's an 80s song, and this movie is supposed to be today, now, and Elle is very today and now. So, good choice by the director. The opening shot in the script is someone's hair. I don't know, man. Listen, these screenwriters are very talented. They've written hit movies, one after the other after the other. So, honestly, I don't know what they were thinking with this opening. Having the movie open outside on a bicycle rider,
AKA a cyclist,
who takes us into the Delta Gamma house. We're now on a tour. You know, the letter being signed and following everybody and bringing us eventually to Elle's door couldn't be more perfect. The other strange thing about moving through the house where we see the three blonde cheerleaders who stop practicing their pom-pom routine to sign the card, It all read a little misogynistic to me, and I say this as someone fully aware that two women who've written several progressive female empowering screenplays were in charge of putting these words to paper. So, and the director, male director, tweaked it ever so slightly, all of this, in a way that just felt much more real, grounded, modern. The name of the dog changes in the script and in the book. It's Underdog. Can't use that in a movie. There's going to be rights issues, because
no need to fear. Underdog exists.
So can't use Underdog. But I also didn't feel that Underdog fit. Elle is underestimated, but that doesn't make her the underdog. An underdog is someone who has, you know, no chance of winning, whatever it is, right? But we, the viewer, as soon as we know the path that Elle is going on, we're rooting for her because everyone underestimates her. But we, the audience, with all the pipe that's laid about what she knows and who she is and how quick she is and how smart she is and funny she is, we're very aware of what she can do. So she ain't the underdog. I mean, this goes for the book as well. I'm sure the book lays similar pipe. It takes a little bit longer to get there. And like I said, it's a little bit clunkier. But it's doing the same thing. It's bringing her to the same place by the end. So you, the reader, and you, the viewer, we know Elle is someone not to be trifled with. Everyone around her underestimates her because of how she looks and the things that she's interested in. But knowing that that doesn't make her less of a smart person is what makes it fun for us, the viewer, the reader, to follow her journey. So to name the dog Underdog in an attempt to be on the nose, it doesn't work. And in case you can't tell, it drives me a little crazy that it's there. Okay. I'm not sure Bruiser really fits either, which is what the dog is called in the movie. There are at least three dogs named Fendi just in my neighborhood. I guess it shows Elle's got a sense of ironic humor about her, which is also good. Also, in 10 pages, Elle never actually says the name of the dog in the script, which I think is weird. The other thing I just wanted to say about the name Underdog is that it doesn't tell us anything about Elle, whereas, like I just said, the name Bruiser tells us a little something about Elle and her sense of humor. Another minor thing that was removed from the script is there's a line, an equally perfectly manicured hand with a Sisters Forever charm bracelet dangling from the wrist. I like that that was removed because it doesn't seem to fit the inimitable style of Elle. And I'd say that even by the end of page one, it's very clear that we're in a sorority of very tight sisters. We don't need to also see the bracelet. It was redundant by this point. I found it interesting, the commentary on Elle's room and style in the script versus the movie. For instance, behind her, a Go USC banner is pinned to the pink wall. A stack of Cosmopolitans and Glamours teeters on the dresser. Those Cosmos are stacked, but they're not a giant mess and they're not teetering. The banner, by the way, says Homecoming Queen. Those changes give us much more interesting insight into Elle herself, rather than just being a messy college student who's into fashion. It's more like those are her encyclopedias. You know, they're the most important reference she has, so she takes good care of them. So I think that's a fantastic change. And again, just a subtle little thing about knowing who your characters are. It could have been the set decorator, it could have been the director that made that choice. It could have come out of a conversation with Reese Witherspoon. What I'm saying is, ultimately, someone made a very minor tweak that better defines the character we're following. There's all that barbecue stuff going on in the backyard. Thankfully, all of that was removed. It doesn't come off well. It doesn't sound right. It doesn't fit the forward-thinking style of what the movie is trying to achieve, and mostly does achieve, except with the exceptions that Reese Witherspoon herself has pointed out, like the bend and snap. There's a line about Warner's grandmother flying in from Newport, Connecticut or something. Yeah, all of that East Coast stuff is gone. It all misses the market. This is not an East-West rap beef. Another thing from those first 10 pages is Elle helping out that girl Amy, setting her up with those guys, the naked golfing story. Again, all that was cut right out. I'm glad it was. We don't need that to know that Elle is good with people. It's not setting up the thing that the writers clearly wanted to set up here. It's clunky, it's awkward, it's feeling like the wrong approach for both Elle and how she cares for her sisters. It just, yeah, doesn't work. That part in the script where I laughed because it said an attractive finger rings the doorbell, that stuff was excised too. Like that frat guy scene, this stuff is actually impeding us from getting into Elle's world. so that while Elle Woods herself isn't sure she can give up her dependence on Warner, the fact that she has people who need her, it's the first bit of foreshadowing that shows us she won't need him in the end, that she's this strong woman who commands attention. When we get into the restaurant, pretty much everything that's in the script is in there. It's pared down a little bit, some of it is switched around. The jokes land differently because of it being switched around, and they land, in my opinion, better than in the script. After the dinner in the script, right at the end, just before we cut off our script read, we got that line, "It's a starry romantic night. Everything should be perfect. It's not." It's a strange line to have in a script. These are not things that generally a screenwriter is A, deciding, nor is it something that a director is putting on screen exactly. We just lived Elle's experience with her. We just saw what happened at dinner. So the whole "everything should be perfect, it's not" is weird, unless you were saying, like, I don't know, they walk into the sorority house, and because Elle's expecting this engagement party for herself, it would be "everything should be perfect, it's not" there, and then explaining it's already gotten around campus that Warner broke up with her, and so people are pulling down the streamers and hiding the gifts and stuff like that. So it's not a detail that makes sense. Another strange detail was his perfect cheekbones highlighted by the street lamp. I don't know, man. It's not adding anything. It's not creating a sense of tone or feeling. I don't know why this is here. I think this is one of those cases where someone really saw a vision here and realized that in spite of a couple of minor things that don't work in this script are easily fixed. His perfect cheekbones highlighted by the street lamp is something that a director's gonna read and roll his eyes and move on. He's gonna like, okay, who cares? You know, I'll get the actor that I get, whether he has cheekbones or not. The other and the final thing that really stood out to me that I thought was just truly bizarre in this script is Margot and Serena emerge from the bathroom post-shower, getting ready for a night out. I mean, were they in the one shower together? Are they going to be jiggling around in towels for the rest of the scene? Is that what's supposed to happen here? Because that, again, seems very much against what this movie's for. I'm for it. But I'm not supposed to have a say. It's very weird. Okay, let's talk movie. What is on screen and why it works? The movie opens with music mixed with a montage of people on a college campus focusing on a sorority. We especially focus on attractive college girls doing girly things like cheerleading and putting on makeup, and the card signed by a bunch of the girls, which is eventually delivered to our main character, whose dog we meet, and we learn that she's expecting, not the dog, but the girl, her boyfriend to propose, and all of her sorority sisters are helping her prepare. This sets up the sisterhood and belief in supporting each other, something that becomes very important to Elle when she becomes sort of an outcast at Harvard Law School. And she actually says it to Selma Blair's character, and maybe other characters come to think of it, but she definitely says it to Selma Blair's character later on. We meet her two besties who go shopping with her, and then the sales lady at the dress shop tries to rip her off, and we learn that there is no fooling Elle. She is smarter than she looks, and she knows her stuff. She's not going to be anybody's fool. Also, she's quick and notices details. This becomes very important to her character as she becomes a lawyer. It comes up at least twice later on. Warner, thinking of Elle as just a girl to have fun with, sets up Victor Garber's Professor Callahan seeing her the same way. These two conservative, narrow-minded men have a very specific way of viewing her. In the first 10 minutes of the movie, we get everything we need to know about Elle. Sure, the movie has a proper first act, but everything about Elle is in those first 10 pages, minutes. We see how she interacts with the people who support her and her best friends and the rest of the sorority. We see how she handles people who don't. Warner, for instance, after that experience, she still remains optimistic. She makes jokes and retains her sense of humor. She's quick enough to throw his words back at him. There's a great detail, by the way, in the moment. After boyfriend Warner has broken up with her, he talks her into getting into the car for a ride home by appealing to her most base nature. "You're gonna ruin those shoes," he says to her. What's great about that, it foreshadows the movie's climax. We're barely 10 minutes in. Her love of shoes bookends the movie. In sum, the script, while still very strong, seems to stray from its main point a little bit, seems to stray from the necessities of the character of Elle a little bit, and necessities of the movie's A-plot that it's setting up. that early on. The director came in, honed it beautifully, pared it down, switched a few things around, and made it very clear who Elle was, what world we're in, i.e. Elle's world, why she deserves other people's respect. All of that is very clear in those first 10 minutes of the movie, and to a lesser degree, but still in the first 10 pages. There are a couple of other things I wanted to mention. There's something about, this is the type of girl I need to become, and someone else, what, practically deformed?
I don't get it. I want to get it, but I don't get it. I don't know. I love that director Oz Perkins is in this movie playing a character that feels like he could be in one of his own horror movies. And then the last thing I want to mention is that in a weird bit of TV trivia, the dad of Elle, played by actor James Reed, he played a character on an 80s detective series, Remington Steele. This was the TV series that gave Pierce Brosnan his big break. Immediately after we see James Reed, we cut to a guidance counselor played by an actor named Elise Beasley. She was the receptionist on Remington Steele's mid-80s detective series successor, an arguably bigger hit, Moonlighting. Someone involved in the casting was casting in TV in the 80s. Or either that or was a big fan of 80s comedy detective series, of which Remington Steele and Moonlighting were among the best. Just a fun little bit of trivia. That's it. I think we've discussed everything. See, I like to keep it short and to the point. So short and to the point it is. I'm out. See you at the table read.
If you want to continue this conversation and follow me on the socials, I love talking movies, TV, and comic books at The Reality Comics on Blue Sky, which is like Twitter but not, and Instagram. That's both at The Reality Comics. Thank you so much for listening. See you at the table read. The first 10 pages is written, hosted, and edited by Keith Planet. Music by Edison Carter. Any corrections, questions, or comments, please reach out via social media on Blue Sky or Instagram at The Reality Comics. The first 10 pages, copyright 2026.
Me.